From beautiful Las Vegas, Nevada, it's The Fake Shack with our hosts, Jim Chofty and Kendall Tenney.
The past 3 weeks have been, there's only one word, incredible. We've used it a lot. We're going to use it a lot more. And I every morning when I wake up and every morning we get into a new town, I say, well, it can't get more hectic. It can't get more fantastic. And it does.
That's the voice of author Ivor Davis. Back in 1964, he was commenting on going on tour with the Beatles. As a reporter, Davis was a young reporter for the London Daily Express, and he worked in Hollywood. At the time, he was doing stories on Liz Taylor, Paul Newman, and all the Hollywood elite. But then came the assignment of a lifetime when he was going to cover the Beatles from the inside on their American tour. Now, where were the Beatles at this point? Well, they had just appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show a few months before. And before coming over to the States, they did an interview on a British TV show called The Roundup.
There have been a lot of changes since this time last year. You know, we've seen you making films and doing all sorts of marvellous things, but what have the changes meant to you?
Nothing really. I think the main changes are in people's attitudes to you. It's people who change rather than you. You know, we feel exactly the same, really.
But you've made a film since then,
mm-hmm.
And you just finished it. Why did you make a film?
Well, it's a logical step, isn't it? And I believe it's quite lucrative, I believe.
Anyway, someone asked us. You know,
yeah, we were asked to do it. We said, yeah.
It's called A Hard Day's Night.
Hard Day's
Night. At your
local
cinema now.
What difference is there since last June up to now? What sort of things have happened to you since then?
The main difference is that we've got more money and less time to ourselves. You know, everything's speeded up and we're just running around like mad.
Do you find any difficulty in keeping up your public image? Just
no.
What image?
It's our image is just... us.
Ivor Davis has written a book called The Beatles and Me on Tour, and he's on the phone with us right now to talk about that crazy time with the Fab Four. Let's set the stage. We've been talking about this a little bit already. Now, I believe it was August of 1964. Your editor in London calls you at your home in Los Angeles, and what does he tell you?
He said, the Beatles are arriving today in San Francisco. And I said, the who? No. And so I heard about them, of course. They weren't well known in America except for the Ed Sullivan Show. And so yeah. I said, okay, off I go. Jumped on the plane. And within a couple of hours, I'd met the Beatles and we were off and running.
Now, at the time, you're a young reporter covering the happenings in Hollywood, right? You're covering different celebrities and things like that. So the Beatles, like you say, had made a splash on Ed Sullivan a few months earlier. Now, that was quite a splash. There were something like 74 million viewers. And
you're absolutely spot on, yes.
If I'm not mistaken, A Hard Day's Night had just been released the month previous.
Yes, and in fact, I don't think the film had opened in America, because when I was on tour with the Beatles in that year, 64, the promoter in Atlantic City had a treat for us, and he brought the Beatles. We all went up to the Beatles' suite. Then there was a party on the same floor, and the Beatles film, Hard Day's Night, was shown to us.
Wow.
The actual Beatles left the premises, because what happened was, it is kind of an unusual story, was the Atlantic City promoter was very happy with the crowd and the turnout, and he decided to show the movie to us and the Beatles, and at the same time he added a special treat, and the special treat we discovered as we were standing there was that in came nine rather scantily clad women, and the promoter actually, in front of us, said to the Beatles, take your pick. Now, I was totally distraught because he never asked me to take my pick. So, you know, I stood there empty-handed, and the Beatles, for a moment, were goggle-eyed, and finally they just grabbed the hand of the lady that they fancied, and off they went. And the lights went down, and we watched the movie, and I had nobody's hand to hold except my own.
You know, it's amazing, too, because even though they were young at the time that you were with them, they were much older than their years, weren't they? Because of all, I mean, when they were in Hamburg for those years at that time.
Absolutely, Jim, you're absolutely right. When they came over, there was a feeling that because Brian Epstein had cleaned them up from Hamburg, from those greasy kids in leather jackets, to nice-looking boys with the same haircuts, with suits and ties, who bowed to the audience, the image of the Beatles was pretty clean cut.
Yeah.
But as you pointed out, you know, they spent many months playing 12-hour, all through the night, stints at the strip clubs of Hamburg's red light district. So they knew what was going on, except the image was that they were nice, clean-cut boys.
You were given unrestricted access, which is something that not many had been given in terms of reporters.
Well, I joined them in San Francisco. I joined them the morning after they'd arrived late that night in San Francisco. I flew up at midday the next day. I went to the hotel, the Hilton Hotel. Derek Taylor, who was their guy, great guy, introduced me to the Beatles. The Beatles kind of grunted. They were watching themselves arrive on color television the night before, and they were all totally and utterly jet-lagged. So it wasn't a great warm welcome, but as we went along, as you said, I mean, the remarkable access was that we all were on the same floor. We had adjoining rooms. I mean, they had a suite, the same floor, and we had the opportunity to walk in and out without guards or police. And it was remarkable because today you wouldn't get within a mile of a rock star.
Yeah. Now, were you prepared? Were you actually prepared for what you were about to see in terms of the hysteria that was coming from the crowd?
Absolutely not. I mean, I didn't know. I'd seen the Beatles show on television, like, as you said, 74 million other people. But somehow, I wasn't prepared. I mean, when I arrived at the San Francisco Hotel, it was surrounded by young women screaming. So I thought, well, you know, this is kind of an aberration. But then when I went to the first concert, it was unbelievable. The girls screamed from the start to finish, so much so that you couldn't hear the music.
Could they hear the music? Because I've always heard that they said they just kind of played and
they did their 10 songs, and they went through it like gangbusters, bang 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 each song. And Ringo said many times he never knew what song they were singing, and he lost the way, and he became a great lip reader. So eventually he could read their lips, and he could realize that he was on the song behind, and he better get up to the song they were singing. It was crazy, and the noise level was deafening. So the Beatles couldn't hear themselves, I couldn't hear themselves, and I don't think the girls in the audience could hear. So it was kind of a weird scene all over the place. I mean, in Vegas at the convention center, two concerts, one in the afternoon, one in the evening. Same noise level, same deafening screams, and same impossible to hear what they were singing.
Security has come such a long way since those days, Ivor. Did you ever feel maybe a little bit nervous about the lack of security?
Well, in a way, yes, and in a way, no. But there were a lot of policemen around. There were a lot of cops around. I mean, every cop was being brought in, and of course, they all wanted to come in and see what these guys were all about. And it was scary because the police were not trained to handle ferocious, screaming, fiendish young 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds. I mean, they could probably handle riots with adults, so they either manhandled the girls or they treaded too softly. And so the girls, of course, they couldn't care less. They wanted to get up on the stage. And a few times they did get up on the stage, but the Beatles by now were used to that. And very often there was a girl hanging onto John's legs while he continued playing. until Mal Evans, the road manager, or Neil Aspinall, the other road manager, sort of yanked the girls off the boys and dropped them back into the audience.
We're talking with Ivor Davis. Go to ivordavisbeatles.com if you want to look at all of this great stuff. And the name of the book is The Beatles and Me on Tour. Living here in Las Vegas, one of the, I suppose you could call it one of the more scandalous stops happened right here in Las Vegas. The Beatles were playing at the Sahara Hotel, and especially where John was concerned. Tell us what happened.
Here's what actually happened. After the concerts, the Beatles had a little party in their suite at the Sahara. And at the Sahara, of course, the security guy and the entertainment manager decided that obviously they wouldn't come into the casino because it would have been bedlam. So he took several slot machines up to their room for the photo op.
Yes.
But later in the day after the concerts, there was a woman, a mother, who was getting a little bit distraught because she said that her kids were partying with the Beatles and she wanted to go up to the Beatles suite to retrieve them. The security people at the Sahara had heard that story before and said, no, I'm afraid, madam, you have to wait down here. She got very upset. She called the local police saying that the Beatles had absconded with their daughter. She couldn't get them back. The police of Las Vegas, sheriffs, I think it was, came over. They went up to the hotel room. There was a fairly harmless party going on, but the problem was that the girls were no doubt underage, having a party in the Beatles suite, and for a moment there was a little bit of panic because underage girls, a serious offense. I want to tell you that Brian thought this was going to scuttle the whole thing, but they finally managed to smooth things over. I don't think anything really serious happened with the girls, but then once the mother retrieved the girls, everything was okay. And then Derek Taylor, the press guy, told me several months later that the mother had threatened to charge them with whatever to their daughters, and rather than go through the publicity or the scandal that it might have ensued, the Beatles ended up paying her off. So that was early in the tour, and if that had happened, sexual scandal with underage girls in Las Vegas, that would have destroyed the whole attitude, ambience, and it would have been a different history. But fortunately, they managed to get over that hiccup and carry on with their tour. And believe me, they try to make absolutely certain that if there were any girls that came to parties or hobnob with them, and I use hobnob in a rather general way, that they were of the right age.
Ivor, can you imagine what would have happened if it was now? I mean, with the social media platforms that we have.
I mean, that's the big difference, Jim. You've got to realize, and you put your mindset, this is 1964, this is 50 years ago. We didn't have Twitter, we didn't have any internet, and the only way of hearing about things was radio and television and newspapers. And today, it would be on Twitter within 50 seconds, and it would have been around the world in another 10 seconds. So from that point of view, it was good that we didn't have the communication systems that they have today.
Yeah, I think John Kennedy probably would have been run out of office if we had known what was going on.
We would have known about all the women that trotted up to the White House. Certainly, everybody in the Kennedy inside group knew that John Kennedy was a bit of a philanderer, but that never came out until much later, did it?
There were some celebrity fans who would come knocking at their door, not the least of which was Hollywood sex symbol at the time, Jane Mansfield. What happened there? Anything?
Jane Mansfield, who was a great operator when it came to publicity, because she, you know, her background was that she was being groomed to step in if Marilyn Monroe at 20th Century Fox stepped out of line. So Jane never made the big time, although she was quite a big bosomed young lady. She knew how to handle PR, and one day she showed up at the Beatles store in Beverly Hills and said she wanted pictures taken with them. Brian said no, but she managed to persuade John to bring two of the other Beatles to the Whiskey A Go-Go nightclub the next night to see a guy called Johnny Rivers perform. We knew they were going. Paul was off with his girlfriend at the time, a young actress called Peggy Lipton. And so he didn't show up to the Whiskey Go-Go. I showed up at the Whiskey Go-Go, and there appeared Jane Mansfield, John, Ringo, and George, thinking they were having a sort of a fairly discreet night out, but instead they were occupying a center booth at this nightclub, surrounded by paparazzi, as we watched them get drunk during the evening. Well, the Beatles were very uncomfortable. George was getting a bit drunk, and finally he said to a photographer, and in those days they had those huge speed graphic cameras that used to stick under your nose with a flashbulb. And they actually, one guy kept shooting George from about 4 feet away. And finally, George said, would you kindly leave? He actually didn't quite say it that way. He said it in a stronger term. But I think you can get the gist. So he told the guy to bugger off or sod off or whatever.
Right.
And the guy took another picture. George was absolutely furious. He picked up his drink and threw it at the photographer. But he missed the photographer, and it landed on another bosomy actress who happened to be close by, called Mimi Van Doren. Van Doren was like second division. Jane Mansfield was first division. Marilyn Monroe was top division.
Yeah.
And so Mamie got doused in George's drink. There was a lot of screaming. They decided to get the heck out of the place, and they all were lifted over the crowd by the nightclub security, and they were gone. The next day, I sat with George in the plane as we were leaving, and George picked up the paper, Herald Examiner LA, saw his picture, of him throwing a drink at the photographer, and George said, "We're not going to let movie people manipulate us for publicity." And George actually was very anti-publicity, despite the fact that the Beatles needed publicity. So that was their rather bad experience with showbiz people. However, they did like Bob Dylan, whose work they admired, and they also, John, admired Joan Baez, who at the time was Bob Dylan's girlfriend. But Bob Dylan said, "Keep your hands off of Joan, she's with me."
Yeah, and so here's some marijuana, you know, to keep you happy while I'm...
In fact, he did, yes. He introduced him to a high grade of marijuana, which was quite funny because I was there at the hotel and Dylan showed up looking like a kind of a gypsy peddler, looking very unsavory. He brought with him good marijuana, gave a fat cigarette to Ringo. Ringo didn't know the protocol.
Mm-hmm.
He was supposed to have 3 puffs and pass it on. Yeah, Ringo smoked the whole thing. He promptly, about half an hour later, almost fell on his face, giggling, and realize that you're supposed to share your pot, not be selfish and keep it for yourself. But that was quite a remarkable scene.
And that was their first experience with pot,
their
I'm assuming.
First experience of good quality stuff. They tried, they were on pills, they supposedly had a few puffs of cigarettes in Hamburg, but nothing very serious. But this was really heavy-duty, top-grade quality pot.
You mentioned this very briefly a couple of moments ago, but Paul had a little bit of a fling with actress-model Peggy Lipton. This was before she did the Mod Squad, I'm assuming.
It was before she did the Mod Squad, and of course it was before she got married and had kids. She married Quincy Jones, of course, but she actually told me at a party that she was going to marry Paul.
Yeah.
And of course, it didn't quite work out that way because, and I sort of kept in touch with Peggy. And then the next year, when Paul came back on tour with the Beatles in America, she hobnobbed with him a little bit. And then the following year, she showed up at the Beverly Hills Hotel where Paul was staying. And lo and behold, he presented his girlfriend at the time, a lady called Linda Eastman.
Okay.
Peggy realized she was not going to marry Paul.
Now, tell us about the boys meeting with Elvis Presley, who I know at the time must have envied them because of what they were doing.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The situation was that Brian Epstein had met Colonel Tom Parker. Colonel Tom Parker had brought them gifts the first year. And the two men, after all, had a lot in common. They were handling hot talents. But at the time, Elvis was somewhat on the decline and had been knocked off the top perch by the Beatles. At the same time, Elvis was a little bit upset, and that's probably a slight understatement, because he was making 3 movies a year, the same movie every time.
Yeah.
Elvis made these 3 movies. The plot was slightly different. He sang slightly different songs, but otherwise they were carbon copies. So he was very upset that Colonel Parker, his manager, had signed him up to this slave labor movie schedule. And all of a sudden, the Beatles come along, knock Elvis off the top of the hit parade, and at the same time, of course, make 1 movie called A Hard Day's Night, and it gets rave reviews. So finally, in the summer of 1965, I get a call to say, Elvis has invited the boys to his house. I go over to the Beatles' rented house, and we ride over to Elvis's house, and there we are, the final summit. But the funny thing is that when we got in there, nobody was there to do the protocol again. Nobody actually said, "I'd like to, John, I'd like you to meet Elvis and Paul." Finally, after about 20 minutes of standing around, Paul went up to Elvis and shook his hand and said, "I'm Paul," and then the Beatles did the same. And finally, even after that, Elvis was watching television. The communication was not very good, and then all of a sudden he jumped up and said, "I'm going to bed. Didn't you guys come here to jam?" And the Beatles said, "Yeah." And so they brought out the guitars, plugged in, and they started playing music for 15 minutes, and the ice was broken, but it took a long time for them to actually start communicating. And they communicated pretty well. It was quite a nice evening. And then, of course, when they left, they said, "Oh, we'll see you again," but they never did. Many years later, Ringo and the Beatles were very upset because Elvis badmouthed them to Richard Nixon.
Yes, yeah.
I discovered the reason, and I was telling this story at the Beatles convention, when a guy came over to me and introduced himself and said he was Elvis's half-brother. He said the reason that Elvis badmouthed the Beatles to Richard Nixon was he desperately wanted to get a Drug Enforcement Agency badge. And that was his reason for saying that. Beatles resented Elvis giving them a hard time, and that was the only time the Beatles met Elvis. Remarkably, strangely, Jim, no photographers were there to record this.
It's amazing, and it's just such an eventful tour with all the things that went on. Some of the opening acts, which included the Righteous Brothers, who I understand eventually realized that we can't do this anymore. These fans are clamoring for the Beatles whenever we go up on stage.
Exactly. You've hit the nail on the head. What happened was they could have brought on the top Vegas acts. Nobody cared about who was opening for the Beatles. All they wanted was the Beatles. So as you said, they had the Righteous Brothers, they had Jackie DeShannon, they had some good opening acts. And finally, as you pointed out, the Righteous Brothers one day in New York were so fed up because as they were singing, the Beatles helicopter came hovering over, drowning out their music. They went to Brian Epstein and said, "Look, Brian, we love being with the Beatles, but nobody cares about us. Do you mind if we leave?" And they did leave. The Queen of England could have taken over from the Righteous Brothers. Nobody wanted to know at the audience about the opening acts. They all wanted just the Beatles.
You know, a similar incident with Jimi Hendrix opening for the Monkees, and he was booed off the stage.
Well, isn't that amazing? You know,
yeah.
That, and I'm sure you know your rock and roll. There's probably other famous musicians who opened for more famous musicians who were ignored.
Your time with the Beatles, by the time the tour ended, were you fairly close with the boys? Was it a good relationship by the time you left?
It was a good relationship because don't forget, the reason was that I was stuck in with them in the hotel because they were prisoners in their own hotels. They didn't have anybody to talk to except Eric and their close inner circle. I was on the tour from day one. And we used to hang out, and they used to complain about the terrible sound systems in the stadiums, which were terrible. And they complained about the awful merchandising. So as a result, I was the only alternative, if you like. So we became quite friendly, and they were very relaxed. They would speak their mind, whereas they were always wary of strangers who were trying to exploit them. And so we ended up on pretty good terms. But as I say, it was a matter of that's all they had. It was me and their inner circle.
Now, I read that you would play Monopoly with John, and he was a terrible cheat.
Yes, he was. Because for some reason, he'd call me and say, we're playing about 2:30 in the morning. We're going to play Monopoly right now. Are you coming over? Well, you know, you don't often get John Lennon asking to come and play games.
Yeah.
So I went over there. There was me. There was Kurt Gunther, who was a great photographer on the tour. So we played Monopoly, but John, for some reason, wanted to buy property. And, he wasn't really a financier, but he liked to land on the property he wanted. So when he rolled the dice, and it never got the number that he needed, he kept rolling until he did. So that was his Monopoly passion. And then we played poker, which he wasn't very good at, and which he lost a bit of money to myself and to the photographer, Kurt Gunther. We were stuck all together because the Beatles couldn't step outside their hotel. We could, I could, and the poor Beatles, every time they arrived in the city, they weren't too sure where they were. Now, I must tell you that John actually said to me that he loved to have spent more time in Las Vegas because he was in awe of the fact that all the hotels were carved out of the desert. But
yeah.
Of course, they couldn't leave. They could not leave the Sahara. And I understand, and you can probably tell me this, the Sahara is no longer there, and it's got a new name.
Yeah, the SLS is what it's called now.
Okay, SLS. Okay, that sounds very glamorous. I'm not sure what it means, but...
It's all very corporate these days, Ivor. By the way, when you were there and you're with them every day, did you see any future music being written while you were with the guys?
Yes, I did, because what happened was that Paul said that they had to do an album, a Christmas album, and therefore they needed 10 or 12 new songs. Now, don't forget, this was September, and the Christmas album was due out in December. So whenever they had a spare moment, I mean, they wrote music on the plane. We had a private plane, so they could go off into the back of the plane and write music. And then a couple of times, I walked into their suite and saw John and Paul sitting on the floor, surrounded by paper, scrawling. And I knew that they were composing something. So, you looked at it. I took a quick look, realized they were at work, and left. I know that they had to get a lot of songs out and that Brian Epstein, their manager, was a huge taskmaster in making sure that they wrote new music for new albums.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating read, your book. And again, you go to ivordavisbeatles.com to get all the info, but make sure that you go there and order the book. It's The Beatles and Me on Tour. It just must have been a magical summer for you.
Well, it was a magical summer. And the remarkable thing was it took me almost half a century to finally put it down on paper, only because I went on to other stories, and every time I told friends over dinner parties about my travels with the Beatles, they were absolutely mesmerized, so I finally thought I better get it down before my mind goes, but my mind hasn't gone yet, although my mind is going to Las Vegas in a few days, and you never know what will happen there.
Ivor, a pleasure talking to you. Best of luck with the book. I know that I've really enjoyed spending some time with you.
And I've enjoyed talking to you, Jim. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Part of the reason Ivor said that he really didn't get to the book until much later in life, listen to some of the other things that he did. He traveled with Bobby Kennedy and was at the Ambassador Hotel the night that he was assassinated. He was smuggled into the University of Mississippi when James Meredith enrolled, and on the front lines of the Los Angeles Watts riots 3 years later. Be sure to pick up his book. It's a great read.
The Fake Show is filmed in front of a live studio audience. Join us next time from Studio G inside Jim Tofty's house and talk with all your friends at thefakeshow.com.